And welcome again to the Torah class in which we periodically study Torah. So as you can see, this morning we have a screen up, and also I forgot my watch, so I'll have to check this every now and then to see what time we're at. Yes, we're going now. No slides of Shechem. Slides of a place more primitive than Shechem, however, in some ways. So as many of you know, I got back last night from Haiti. And some of you obviously don't know that I got back last night from Haiti. I don't know why you don't keep up with my travel schedule. That's unimaginable to me. But so I want to tell you the background of it, and then I want to show you some slides. Not like, here's my trip to Haiti kind of slides, but just what's going on there. Because I don't know about you, but I have actually never been to any place at all comparable. I've driven through the streets of Mexico. That's about as close as I got, but that doesn't begin to prepare you for the devastation of a place like Haiti, which is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere before the earthquake. So now, you'll see when I show you the slides. And the reason that I went there, I'm going to talk about it on Shabbat, but the reason that I went there, and since I can't show slides on Shabbat, I thought this was a perfect opportunity to do that. I'm also going to do it tonight for the Atid group. Even though I'm talking about relationships, I'm going to start off with this. But the reason that I went there is because my friend from almost middle school, I guess, we met in sixth grade, Mitch Albom, author of Tuesdays with Maureen, sports writer, and so on. So the last time I was talking to him, he talked about this orphanage that he was building in Haiti. And this was several months ago. And I said, you know, Jed, I'd love to go sometime. And then the last time I was talking to him, he said, remember, you said you'd love to go sometime. Well, I'm going in January. I said, I'll go. He said, if you can swing a hammer, you can come. And I said, well, I can, but I'll come anyway. And what happened was, the background of the story, I'm writing it for the Jewish Journal also, so I hope I won't tell you this too many times, is that 30 years ago, this pastor, John Hearn, whose picture I think you will see, built this orphanage in Haiti, did a mission in Haiti, which a lot of Christian churches did. He's a pastor out of Detroit. And it was hard to sustain, and he didn't have much money. And there were some successes, but there were also failures. And after the earthquake, he had nothing and couldn't raise a penny because there was so much need in Haiti. And he was on Mitch's show. Mitch has a radio show in Detroit, and he was talking about this. And at the end of the show, Mitch said, I want to see it. So he went down there and decided basically to adopt the orphanage. And he's been there six times between the earthquake and now, and is planning four more trips in the next year. And he brings with him a crew. They came with 22 people this time in a jet that was given to them by Roger Penske, because they had to bring supplies. Penske is apparently a wonderful man, a good Christian, very charitable. They had to bring supplies. You couldn't bring them on commercial airlines. You can't bring huge vats of medicine, other things. Or hammers, or power tools, or all the things that they need to bring down. So they flew his jet down. They brought, as I said, 22 people. I came from LA and met them at the airport, the so-called airport, the landing strip. And he brought with him a nurse, a doctor, a nurse practitioner, a nutritionist to plan meals for these kids, and the most remarkable collection of, I mean, he started it with two friends, Mark Mendelson and Mark Rosenthal. So, okay, three Jews, one a friend from childhood and one his college roommate from Brandeis. And they gathered around them this collection of builders and basically all around do-gooders, all of whom are Christian, two of them Christian pastors, who main profession is building. They also pastor churches, and they spend almost all their time traveling around the world doing stuff like this. So while we were there, they were building, and they were building a school, and they were tiling floors and all this stuff. And the amazing thing was, of course, that I said to the nutritionist, I said, you and I, like, we're not being docked. You know, the synagogue is still going to pay me for the days that I'm in Haiti. They're not going to say you were away. But these guys, their business is building. And so not only are they volunteering, but they're also losing whatever business they would do back home. And they don't, I mean, they live in Detroit. They don't make a lot of money, and they all have kids, and they're all sending their kids to school, and it's unbelievable, their goodness. In fact, one of them, his name is Chris Steinle. I was talking to him, and I asked him why he came down, and he started talking about it. All of us, he's big, strong builder guy. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, he starts weeping. not just crying, but weeping, like the tears are pouring down his face. He's talking about these kids and how could he not come down there for these kids? And I thought, just unbelievable. And when Mitch first asked me if I would come down, he said, you know, it's a Christian orphanage. And I said, I know. He said, I know, I mean, like, it's a Christian, they pray every night to Jesus. I said, I can't think of a better place for a rabbi to go. It was, and in fact, there was one teenage girl whose name is Julia. I don't know if you'll see a picture of her. I went to the prayer service at night and I spoke to them. I spoke to the kids. And then afterwards, she came up to me and asked me what that was I was wearing on my head. And I said, it's called a kippah. And she said, I want one. And I said, I'll send you one from Los Angeles. I said, I'll send you a couple of them in different colors. And she said, good, then I'll be Jewish. So I made one convert in Haiti. This is me with a couple of the kids. The kids are incredibly trusting and affectionate, considering the fact that most of them are orphans, and the ones that aren't orphans have been abandoned there by their families. There's one kid, I don't know if we'll see him or not, Dona, who, I don't know how old he is now. Is that any better?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So his name is Dona. He was his mother. I actually start the Jewish Journal story with this kid. His mother got pregnant. They were not married. She hid it from the father, knowing that he didn't want to have a child. He found out, tried to get her to get an abortion. She ran away, wouldn't have an abortion. When the kid was finally born, the father found him and beat the kid almost every single day till he was 4 or 5 years old, when he ran into the streets and found the orphanage and was taken in. So there are kids who have parents, but, you know, I'm assuming some parents leave them there out of indifference and some maybe out of despair. They have a gate and a guard at the orphanage because everyone knows there's food in there, there are, you know, and there are kids in there. So, kitchen, now being rebuilt. This is what the kitchen was. It was basically two pots. Now they have a stove, they have a range, they have a countertop. This is one of the bathrooms that they need to reconstruct. They need $10,000 to build 3 new indoor bathrooms. And the bathrooms are for 100 kids. So we're not talking about, you know, $10,000 for 3 bathrooms is not bad. Wouldn't it be nice if it said donated by Sinai Temple Torah class? This, of course, of course, this is where they sleep until yesterday when new beds were delivered. And the reason that new beds were delivered was Mitch gives this inspirational talk to them every night, an instructional talk every single night when they gather for their prayer thing. And he made a deal, in quote, with the kids. They all get new beds, new mattresses, which of course they've never seen in their life, but they have to sleep inside. None of them will sleep inside since the earthquake.
Oh.
They're terrified. They're sleeping in the out on this porch because they're all scared to sleep inside. So the deal was, you get beds, but you have to sleep inside. So last night was probably the first night that some of them had slept inside since a year ago. Okay? Yeah, I just thought that was a cute picture. I don't remember what they were delivering. This is John Hearn. This is the pastor of the orphanage, and she grew up in the orphanage, Rolanda, and she now teaches in Morningstar. Morningstar is one of the couple of elite schools in Haiti. There are indoor air-conditioned classrooms. They even have a pool on the grounds, which is obviously very rare. And you can see that she's obviously made it, right? She's a success. It's what Mitch wants to build there is an English language. That's what he's building there, actually, is an English language school, because kids who speak English in Haiti, half of the kids at the orphanage do, the other half only speak Creole. The kids who speak English are the only ones that really have much of a chance to make a decent life for themselves, so the school's going to be an English language school. There's a basketball court, and in fact, apparently, I'm told I was on ESPN, because 3 of us played 3 of them. The ESPN followed Mitch around for 2 days doing a story on this. 3 of us played 3 of them in basketball. We didn't win. Okay, this is Junior. This is Junior, and you can read the story. He came up to me out of nowhere, and he puts his arm around me. He says, hi, I'm Junior. So I said, hi, Junior. And he told me his real name, which I don't even remember. He said, but you don't have to remember, because everybody calls me Junior. And we started talking, and then I asked him the question that you ask every kid in Haiti, which is, what do you want to do when you get older, to see if they have any sense. And I'll say something about that in a second, and that's what he said to me. He said he wants to be a doctor so he can be a blessing to his country. The key issue, one of the aid workers that I was talking to, not from the orphanage but elsewhere, the key issue, he said, in Haiti is that the kids have no sense of if-then. He said they've never been taught, if they do this, then they can become something. So the kids who actually have aspirations are already way ahead. In fact, when we went to Morningstar to talk to some of the educators there, and the woman there said, the first thing we have to do is teach kids how to think. So Mitch said, what do you mean how to think? I mean, human beings think. And she said, drive around the camps, you'll see little kids sitting there staring all day long. Parents don't talk to them, they never give them a book. She said, you don't realize as an American how much stimulation every kid gets. She said, so when they come to the school, they've never been told how to think or engage in a conversation or look at a book or any of these things. So you have to teach them how to think.
Why don't the parents talk to you?
Because they weren't talked to either. I mean, it's long before the earthquake. I mean, also, if you look at the tent camps, I don't know, I don't think I could survive there a week. I mean, they're just, and by the way, as hard as it was to be there even for a few days, it was also, the hottest it got was 85. Living in the tent camps when it's 115 in the day, and there's nowhere to go. I mean, there's literally nowhere to go. It's not like, well, at least there's an air-conditioned room or a cool place. You're in a tent, and that's it. And the only water, well, I hope I'll show you the water. A lot of them were obsessed with cameras. I don't know if we have the picture of Nahum. It's very, I think that's a palace. This was the first kid that I spoke to when I got there. I don't know if you can see the expression on her face, but there's a certain, some of the older kids have despair and a hardness. Some don't, but some do.
Did they know you were a rabbi?
Some did, but they had no idea what that was. I told them I was a pastor. I mean, they didn't know what Judaism was. So it means nothing to them. They've never met a Jew in their lives. This is the market. Half of what you see is filth and half of it is product. But it's, I mean...
Is this Port-au-Prince?
Yeah, this is all Port-au-Prince. I didn't go out into the provinces, though I'll say something about that in a second. This is the guys who are building the school. This is going on in the grounds of the orphanage. And all I can say is every one of those men that you see there is a saint. Mm-hmm. Honest to God. I mean, they're working. By the way, they've been there all a couple of times. They did the same thing in August when it was 115 degrees. And this is just what they do. And they get nothing. I mean, they get no recognition, no reward. They just do it, and it's unbelievable.
When will it be finished?
This is me doing the only manual labor of my life. I just wanted to get a picture of it. Mitch and I grouted this floor, and we met in the middle. Okay, it took maybe an hour and a half. This is going to be the only office they've ever had at the orphanage. All I can say is, at the end of this, I was drenched in sweat. Right? I mean, and all I was doing was grouting, for God's sakes. And I can't imagine how these guys do it. This is Mitch, and reading to one of the kids. All of them know him. All of them call him Mr. Mitch. And some of them, the older kids realize it. The younger kids obviously don't, but he's their savior. Without him, here's one of the things the night before I left, he talked about the beds, and then the second half of his talk was, you're all gonna learn something new tomorrow. You're gonna have something you never had before. It's called lunch. He said, people should eat three meals a day, not two meals, because they got something in the morning, and then they got something before they went to bed, and that was it. He said, so from now on, and hopefully for the rest of your life, you're actually gonna get three meals a day, so you'll eat also in the middle of the day. They had never, some of them literally had never had three meals a day. So as I say, some of them, the older kids realize what he's doing for them, the younger kids don't. What's that? Ah, I'll talk about that in a second. These are one of the right. These are one of the evening prayers sessions. The songs, most of them are in English because the pastor brought a woman who everyone called Mama. Now she's in her mid-80s and in Detroit, and so she only comes down once or twice a year. And she spoke English, and she didn't speak Creole, so she would only teach them prayers in English and not in Creole.
Are they Roman Catholic?
No, they're not Catholic. They're a combination of Christian and Voodoo. The Voodoo is obviously opposed to the Christian, and they try to suppress it, but it still has... I don't think it's Catholic, though.
So how do they take pictures?
So Nachum walked around with my BlackBerry all day until I took it away from him. He wouldn't... And he would look... All he wanted to see was the world through a camera, right? And so he would walk around, and I would tell him I need that back, and I would take it back, and I'd answer my emails, and then he would come up to me and pull on my pants and say, camera. And I wanted to take a picture of him with a BlackBerry, but I couldn't take a picture of him with a BlackBerry because he had my BlackBerry. So I got someone else's BlackBerry for him to hold, and it doesn't work. The guy's BlackBerry didn't work there, so he's looking at it like, why can't I see my picture? And I snapped this picture, and then I gave him back my BlackBerry. I got to say, I was sure he was going to break it, and then I would be completely cut off from the outside world, but he didn't. The older boys are being trained in construction by the construction workers. Mm-hmm. They're teaching them a trade. And if you, I don't know if you're aware of this, but now there's a whole movement. I mean, why would you be aware of it? I didn't know. I'm talking like I know. I was there for a couple of days. But there's a whole movement to teach construction workers in Haiti simple fixes so that the next time the buildings don't fall. Because the same, a similar magnitude earthquake happened in a town, the name escapes me, in Mexico, also very poor. But they built with simple codes that made the disaster much less. More people died in the earthquake in Haiti than died in the bombing of Hiroshima. I mean, right, almost 300,000. What's that?
I just heard the other day, twice as many as the combination of Nagasaki and...
Of Nagasaki. Over 300,000 people died. And that's, I mean, injuries were... In fact, I don't know if I have a picture of Florence, but if I don't, I'll tell you about Florence and her injury. This is... a typical picture. I don't know if you can see the pig there, but pigs scavenge along the banks of these fetid, filthy, disgusting, disease-ridden streams in which the pigs and dogs defecate and urinate and kids wade. Of course they do. Where else are they going to go when it's burning hot in the middle of the day? And it's like, as Mitch said, they should put up a sign, get your cholera here, right? Because cholera is one of the current scourges. And by the way, cholera didn't come indigenously from Haiti. It came from workers who were in Nepal who came to Haiti, which means also that they're suspicious of anything that foreigners bring in, including medicine, because they think they're trying to poison the Haitians, because they all know that cholera came from outside Haiti. So there's a lot of superstition to combat as well. This is another picture. I mean, the devastation is really unimaginable. And as you all know, pictures don't do justice to actually seeing it, but, you know, I only took a couple of... This is the schoolroom, which is, again, going to be rebuilt, and that's the teacher. And those are the kids that currently, since they only have one class, kids of all ages attend the same school, except for the ones that are lucky enough to go outside to Morningstar. Yeah.
Where did the money we sent last year go?
It depends. Depends who you sent it to. I mean, there's been a lot of work in... I'll come to the general condition in a minute. This is right before I was going to leave, and the kids gathered around, some of them at least, to take a picture to say goodbye the morning before I left. They're incredibly trusting, affectionate. You'll walk in there. If you walked in there today, six kids would hug you and say hello. Just, that's what they do, you know? I just thought she was adorable. And he jumped up into my arms, so I quickly said, get a picture. And there you have it. So I don't have a picture of Florence, and I did want to say something about her. So here's a typical story of which there were thousands, but I'll only tell you one, and then I'll answer whatever questions. Florence and John are married. She's probably in her late 20s. When the earthquake came, John was, he wasn't home. He started pulling people out of the rubble. He saved about 9 or 10 people. She was pulled out of the rubble by a neighbor. Her leg was shattered. She grew up at the orphanage, and she used to help out at the orphanage. So the guys, the builders, Mitch, so on, brought her and her husband to Detroit, where she could get surgery that didn't exist in Haiti to repair her leg. And Tom, what's his last name? Monty, who's one of the, he's a painter and a muralist. So he, like all these guys, he was doing everything. He was mixing cement and so on, but he was also doing most of the painting around there. He had them live at his house for 3 months while she was in rehab. And when I was there was the night she came back. So I mean, they didn't tell me the story, just everybody started to run up to this woman who was walking with a cane, but walking pretty well, and I heard the story. And it's just, the examples of goodness are stunning. I rode back on the plane from, you have to go from Port-au-Prince to Miami and then Miami to LA. So there's an older guy sitting next to me on the plane, older meaning, you know, maybe mid to late 60s, not at, and he's, and I don't remember how we got into conversation. He's a retired software internet entrepreneur, most of his life in Buffalo, now lives in Boston, started an organization that basically recruits volunteers to work around the world. He said when Katrina hit, they went to Biloxi, Mississippi. He said, because we always go to the second order place. First of all, because the big capitals have too many layers of bureaucracy. And second, they get flooded with help. And nobody remembers that people in other cities that aren't being, so they went to the tsunami. They just go around the world. He has 1,000 volunteers on average, and they coordinate them and they work. He says, if you're willing to work and you pay your own way, you can be part of our organization. He said, the worst I have ever seen in the world is Haiti. He said, even the tsunami doesn't compare to Haiti. Because when the tsunami hit, he said, remember, up to here was devastation, but everything beyond that was untouched. He said, but Haiti everywhere, because one of the things that happened, it's amazing how much you can learn if you actually listen to people who know things. So he said, one of the things that happened was that when the earthquake hit in Port-au-Prince, everybody went to their family in the outlying areas. He said, now, the family in the outlying areas were already, I mean, they were barely eking out a living, and there was this huge influx of population which devastated even the places beyond the earthquake region, which were already poor. So one of the things he did, and actually he sent me the website and I took a look at it. This is just, I mean, just the really the depth of human goodness is sometimes astonishing. They went to the epicenter of the earthquake in Lagan, I think it's called. And there was a mass grave there where about 2,500, 3,000 people were dead, but it was just a pit covered with dirt. And the people of the town said to them, can you do something to mark the graves? So he said, I always say, whatever the place needs, somehow God provides the volunteers that, and his is a non-denominational, by the way, his is not a Christian organization, it's a non-denominational organization. Most of them, he said, we're rare. Most of them are Christian aid organizations. So he said, we had two architects with us, and they designed, and I saw it on the website, they designed like a white picket fence that goes all around the place just so that the people would have, and he said, and all along the fence in the model of the Vietnam Memorial, they're going to incise the names of all the people that died there. So, I mean, it's just, it's incredibly moving what people are doing. So, Marcy, you asked where people's money went. Here's the reaction. First of all, a lot of money went to the most basic reconstruction. That is, you can now, even though there's no road that I've ever driven on in the United States that is as bad as some of the best roads in Haiti, right? When you sit in the back of the truck, which is what we did, you know, it's a bumpy ride. So a lot of it went to just clearing out the streets of dead bodies, of rubble, enabling people to get around. That was a huge task. And also, the people in the tent cities are still being fed almost entirely by aid. I mean, they don't have any economy. The water gets trucked in. The food gets trucked in. Mitch has about 55 kids there now. He told me that their capacity is 100. He said, and I'm going to bring it up to 100, but I can't do it too quickly. I have to do it carefully. I said, why? He said, because all I have to do to fill this place is go to one of the 10 cities and say there are openings at the mission. He said, and we will be flooded with hundreds of kids, not all of whom are appropriate to be here. So you have to do it very carefully, and you have to get kids who actually can live with the other kids, and some of the kids don't stay there. If the kids actually can't get along there, then they have to leave. And it's tricky because there are teenagers, some of them, and there are boys and girls there. So that's also a tough, every single second, one of the counselors who are older kids who grew up, not kids, they're in their mid-20s, late-20s, who grew up at the mission, like every second they were coming to Mitch with a problem, and I said to him, what do they do when you're in Detroit? He said, I get phone calls like every 10 minutes. What do I do about this? What do I do about that? One of his constant themes was, when I'm not here, right, Alan, who's one of the, he's me. Whatever he tells you, you have to do, because it's hard to get, you know, hard to get good help in Haiti. So a lot of the money is still going to food aid. A lot of it went to reconstruction, but a lot of it is apparently being held back because the government is so ridiculously bureaucratic, inefficient, and corrupt. And there's an election that's supposed to come up. One of the guys there, Phaedra, his name is, whose father is apparently an important guy in Haiti, he said to me, first of all, he said, look up in those hills. So I looked up in the hills. He said, that's where the 5 or 6 wealthy families who control Haiti live. And he said, really, you know what we need more than anything else? He said, I hate to say this given Haiti's history. He said, but what we need is a benevolent dictator. Which I understand, they need somebody who can run the country, because it's so broken. And yet, having said that, so in fact, somebody called me yesterday who's a pretty well-known philanthropist in the Jewish community, and he said, where are you? And I said, I'm actually at the Miami airport on my way back from Haiti. And that was all I said, okay? I'm way back from an orphanage that a friend of mine is building in Haiti. And the next words out of his mouth were, don't ask me for money, because I'm not putting it into Haiti, because it's a sinkhole. And I'm going to talk to him anyway, but I said, oh, no, I'm not. I just told you where I was. But he's right, by the way. I wouldn't put money into Haiti, but you can save individual lives. I mean, I saw the kids. They're, amazingly enough, as I said, the lucky ones. Those kids are going to be fed and educated. They don't have parents, but they're going to be fed and educated and also disciplined, which is an amazing accomplishment in Haiti. That school that we went to, Morningstar, I have to tell Larry about this, Larry Shinlin. This is how they have the classrooms constructed, okay? Never seen anything like it. The people who, I don't remember the names of the husband and wife who put this school together, but it's brilliant. First of all, you go into the classroom and every kid sits at his own cubicle with partitions, so they can't see the kid next to him facing the wall. Then in the middle of the room, they have almost like Le Pain Quotidien, they have a communal table, right? That's for learning together. But she said the kids in Haiti never learn to focus. And if you let them see the kid next to them, or if you let them look out the window, they won't focus. So we have a book and a wall, and that's all they're allowed to look at until they learn to focus, then they can come to the communal table and learn with each other. They know what they're dealing with. So it's quite remarkable. It was an experience, Mitch said to me, you're not gonna wanna leave. He says, I know this sounds crazy, but you're not gonna wanna leave. And the truth is, you miss those kids when you leave them. They're incredibly, they're vivid, they're alive, and you see in them the possibility. Were you here when Marilyn Berger spoke about Rick Hodes? Changed my view forever, and it affected how I saw these kids. Rick Hodes is one of those super saintly doctors. I mean, Mother Teresa, when she has bad cases, sends them to Rick Hodes. He travels around Africa, he cures people and so on. Okay, so Marilyn Berger, who wrote a book about him, went to Rwanda, where he was working, and on the way to his clinic, she saw this kid in the streets who was bent over. He had stenosis, his spine had a curvature, a scoliosis. So she brought him to the clinic. So Hode said, you actually saved this kid's life. He would gradually have, his spine would have collapsed in on itself. He did an operation, saved the kid, fine. She goes back home and she says to him, he's coming to the United States to visit. She says to him, why don't you bring that boy? I remember him so fondly. He was maybe 10, 11. Brings him to make, she was married to Don Hewitt, who was the producer of 60 Minutes. At the time he had cancer, he was dying. She said, maybe it was just to compensate for my loss. She adopts this kid, okay? Takes him to the public school system, gets him tested in order to get him into the public school. He has an IQ of 178. Head of the public school says, this is the most gifted child I've ever tested in my life. He was on the streets of Rwanda going to die. So I look at these kids in Haiti and I think, you have no idea who's there. I mean, don't forget, as I told one of the pastors when we were, I was telling him this story, don't forget when Jews immigrated to the United States, they assumed we were retarded. I mean, that was the common assumption about Jewish immigrants, right? Because we didn't speak, we weren't educated, we couldn't figure out things that were obvious to Americans because of cultural differences. Go figure. So these same kids, who knows what potential exists there? In fact, I got a really nice email, the first day I put it up on Facebook, from some guy in Berkeley, whom I've never met, who says, you know, I pedal Volvos these days. He said, but I also have access to lots of musical instruments. How about if I collect up some musical instruments and send them to the orphanage? And I thought, what a great idea. What a great idea. So when I say, for example, that I want to raise the money so that they have indoor bathrooms, it's not because I think it's going to save Haiti, but it will save them. So yeah, I think it's a powerful and important thing. It was a tremendous experience. I recommend it to all of you. If for nothing else, to go to the market, for example, and sit down next to one of those guys who has an Amish beard, you know, that is no mustache and Amish beard, and he's sitting there at the market too, and in the market in Haiti, the supermarket, the nice market, the indoor market, the air-conditioned market, it's a display room. It's not, you can't go in there and take something off the shelf. What you do is you go around, you mark what you want on a piece of paper, then you bring it to a second person who brings it to a third person who goes to the warehouse and brings out what you want, and that's how you buy it. And one of the reasons is that they're so afraid of theft of food that they have several levels of check before you can get the stuff. So he's sitting there, he has put in his order, and he's waiting for it to go to the second and the third and the fourth person. And so we start to talk. He's part of this Christian aid group in Ohio, and they're out in the provinces because, again, he said, everybody's concentrating on Port-au-Prince and forgetting about these people in the provinces, and they're building them homes. And that's just what he's doing. And I said, so what got you interested in Haiti? He said, well, my son's been here building for the last couple of years, so I thought, you know, we would all join him since we go around the world and do this. That's what we do. Yeah.
So will you be going back?
I don't know if I can email, I assume I can email the slideshow. Can I email the slideshow? I mean, what I'm gonna do is, first of all, there are, all right, it's all on Facebook, the website. Although you're welcome to just contribute to my discretionary fund and I'll keep a separate Haiti thing, and then when I get enough, I'll send them the check and it'll come from Sinai Temple, which would be really nice. Or I'm also gonna talk to a couple individuals. I can tell you actually, I have it all on my trusty BlackBerry. I was talking to Herbert. Herbert Studsell. Herbert Studsell is the guy who's the on-site manager. He came from Georgia and he got involved with Pastor Hearn. And Herbert Studsell, I talked about, I wrote this also in the Jewish Journal article that I'm writing. He said to me, I asked him for the figures for how much would this cost, how much would that cost, and I'll give you them in a second. But he says to me, he said, as soon as I get the money, I spend the money. I said, why? He said, because as far as I'm concerned, he said, money's like water. He said, rushing water is clean. Water that stays in one place gets impurities. He says, I don't like the idea of collecting people's money so that I can use it. He said, when I get it, I spend it. And I thought that was such a beautiful analogy, you know, as opposed to, okay, so this is what he told me. Medicine for a nurse on staff and biweekly doctor visits and medicine is $18,500 per year. Security at the two gates is $6,500 a year. Education for three teachers 5 days a week and school supplies for 100 kids is $28,300 a year. Utilities are $4,800 a year. That's electricity and water. They turn off the electricity in Haiti at 6 p.m. The orphanage is run by generators, only by generators. Before the last, they brought the generator 3 months ago. Before that, after 6 p.m., there was no electricity. Plumbing for 3 indoor bathrooms is $10,000. Anyway, so, yeah.
How many students are at Morningstar, and how do they choose?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to either of those things. They're great questions, I just don't know. Yeah.
All the workers, this might sound racist, but the workers that came in from out of town, were they also African American, or were they only seeing white men coming in?
They were only white. All the guys from Detroit were white. Yeah.
What did the kids decide from there?
Guys and women, by the way, there were both. Yeah. They sing. Oh, I'm so glad you said that because it reminds. They sing Creole songs, and Mitch has this great video of the first time they built a shower. Now, none of these kids had ever seen a shower in their lives. I told you they all bathe in the stagnant pools around Haiti. So what happens is they say to this one kid, "Okay, we want you to stand under this. Take your clothes off and stand under this." So he takes his shirt off. He starts taking his pants off. They said, no, you can keep your pants on, because all the other kids were gathered around. They said, keep your pants on, just go under this. And they turn it on, and he looks around, like all of a sudden it's raining on his head. And he looks up and he sees the shower, and spontaneously all the other kids start jumping in, and they're all trying to get a bit of it, and they break into some Creole song. It's just the most amazing thing.
Where did you stay when you were there?
At they have the old pastor's room where a bunch of us brought an air mattress with me, which, by the way, because there's a pump attached to it, and also I was bringing a bunch of antibiotics, got me stopped at security for a long time while they went through everything I had. But the security guy, I told him why I had all those drugs with me, and at the end, when he put it all together, he gave it to me, and he said, it's wonderful what you're doing. Go and do good. Mm-hmm. It was really very, it's hard not to feel like a sort of kinship with somebody who's going to an orphanage, for God's sakes. But what did you ask me? Now I don't remember.
I stayed
on the, they had air mattresses, and all of us, all the workers stay inside either on old beds or air mattresses. So it was, yeah.
What is the main source of income, if you can say, or profession of the people over there?
It depends where you live, I guess. Farming, probably in the places where there's farmland. In Port-au-Prince, there's everything. I mean, there are markets and there are professionals, and there are, part of Port-au-Prince is middle class. I mean, not everybody in Port-au-Prince is poor, just most of them. And there are over 1 million people now in tent cities. But that's since the earthquake.
And how do they get water?
It's distributed. That's one of the things that Mitch was saying. He said part of the problem is that it's inevitable. The network of information is so tight that if, let's say, you're tent city A, okay, and you're tent city B. So I have 1,000 pieces of cheese. I'm an aid worker. And I go to tent city A and I say I have 1,000 pieces of cheese. It's not 5 minutes before tent city B knows about it and you get 10,000 people. So distributing aid is a very difficult thing, because there's only so much food you can actually bring at one time. And when you see the tent cities, they stretch as far as the eye can see. And they're just, God, awful. I mean, look, even the clothes that people have to be brought in. Some of them have nothing other than what they're given. So even though there's some economy, I mean, when you walk through the market, you see people buying and trading. And also there are, I don't know, craftsmen, I guess, at the side of the road all the time who are like carving stuff out of wood or building stuff out of stone or whatever it is that they're doing. And also there's a church every 6 feet in Haiti. In the morning, every morning, you can hear the churches across the street and the people singing. And I took a walk around the neighborhood, and every few feet there was a church and you could hear people singing inside. So, yeah.
Is there a Haitian currency, or do they use dollars?
there is a Haitian currency, but I didn't, I mean, I saw it, but most people use, I mean, if you use dollars, they're much, yeah, they're much happier. I don't even know what it's called. I don't even know that anybody used it when I was there. But when you tip people, you tip them in dollars, but there too, you know, you have to be careful because tip one person at the airport and you're surrounded by people who, because their perception is right, right? You have money and they know you have money. And the kind of money that we have is, again, unimaginable. To, on the other hand, like going through security and going through customs at Haiti is indistinguishable from, I mean, the people are just as adept and as educated and as, so there's a lot of different classes, but it's just, yeah. Right. Oh, I have a good argument for colonies. The idea of being a colony is you want to be colonized by the British. I'm serious. Look at the difference between Barbados and Haiti. You don't want to be colonized by the French. You want to be colonized by the British. And every place the British colonized has done, almost without exception, pretty well. I mean, look at the United States. What's the most corrupt state in the United States, by far? Louisiana. What's the one state that has French influence? Louisiana. I mean, it's just stunning. Now, you get a certain joie de vivre, right? You get a certain love of life if you're colonized by the French. But if you actually want a system that works, India, I mean, for all of its vast problems, right? If India had been colonized by the French, believe me, you wouldn't be calling India to get your Dell computer fixed. The British, I don't know, there's something in the British character. Some people have actually, I just read an article not so long ago that said that they think that it's also in the English language, and that may be too, that actually conduces to a certain efficiency and responsibility. So I think the argument for colony is get colonized by the British. That's my advice to all prospective colonies. But boy, it's just, I mean, so one guy told me, I don't know if it's true or not. I don't even know what time it is. I don't know if it's true or not, but one guy told me, yeah. One guy told me that he said 40 years ago, 45 years ago, he said 60 to 70% of all the country's wealth was held by the head of the country in Haiti. I mean, it's stunning how corrupt and, although Preval, who the WikiLeaks, you know, one of them was an evaluation of him. I mean, he seems to be, he's got all sorts of weaknesses, but corrupt accumulation of wealth isn't one of them. So who knows? Who knows? I mean, it's hard enough to understand your own government.
Does Mitch tell you what to bring? Or how did you know to bring antibiotics?
Oh, I just knew. I mean, I just knew that they wanted antibiotics. And the doctors, in fact, while I was there, they used the antibiotics I brought. No, I just brought whatever I had, and I asked a couple friends if you have any, because all of us have antibiotics sitting in our medicine cabinet that in 5 years we're going to look at, and it's going to say expires in 08, and we'll throw it out, right? So I just asked people for their old antibiotics that they're not using, and I, fortunately, having gone through surgery not so long ago, I had enough Augmentin to choke a horse. So I brought several Z-Packs and Augmentin, and also I had drops, antibiotic drops, and I just brought them, and you know, I left the air mattress there. That's another thing is, I said to Mitch, this was part of my naivete. I said, you know, I bought this air mattress at REI for $80, okay? I said, and I'm thinking I'll just leave it here. And he said, you leave everything here. He said, we don't take anything home. Like, obviously, what are you gonna bring an air mattress back home for? So I left all sorts of stuff there. And
like
it's
clothes?
Just
like
some. Yeah, I left some of my clothes there because, mm-hmm. I mean.
Another T-shirt.
Yes, exactly, another T-shirt. What do I care? Because it's absurd, the superfluity of stuff that we have here. And there's nothing that we have that we can't replace.
Yeah.
And we all know this about giving. The hard part of like getting $10,000 for a bathroom isn't that we can't afford it, because actually we would never, you'll never notice if everybody in this class gave X amount of money and you have to decide what that amount of, you know, I mean, in a year, you won't know that you gave it. It's just a function for us of emotionally vaulting over writing that check for $1,000 when we don't have to, right? Which is an emotional, not a financial issue. Yeah.
When you got there, did you feel safe?
I felt safe. Well, I felt safe because I, unlike Mitch, Rosie, who's Mark Rosenthal, whatever I call him, Rosie, Mitch, Rosie, and Herbert went out to the sports bar to watch the college game at night. So Mitch told me that Herbert, who, as I say, he's black and he was born in Georgia, and he's sort of the on-site manager. He took a wrong turn and they ended up in a dead end. And he said to them, "I just want you to know that if guys with guns come, I'm running." So Mitch said, "What does that mean, you're running? What is that? Where are you?" So it's not safe in Port-au-Prince at night. For white or black, but inside the orphanage you felt safe, and during the day driving around in the truck I felt safe. But I mean, you know.
When's ESPN gonna run this?
Oh, they did yesterday apparently. I didn't see it, but I mean, I don't know. Maybe you can get it on the internet. I don't know when. I guess it depends. They're planning on 4 trips in the coming year. I guess it depends how quickly they get it done. I just don't know the answer to that. Anyway. So there you have it. I will tell you, if you make a contribution to my discretionary fund and put Haiti on it, then I will pool them all when we get whatever we get and send it there.
What about books, like children's books?
Yes, I'm sure they could. They certainly, there's nothing that you have that they couldn't use. Yeah, I mean, I can send them. What you do is you send them to Detroit, and then he takes them on the next plane. Yeah.
But clothes, can we give clothes?
I don't want to start collecting clothes. In theory, you could, but I'm not going to start collecting clothes and ship them to Detroit and have them ship from Detroit to there. So I think better to give money to Detroit. You can. Yeah. If you go to havefaithhaiti.org, you'll see the. And again, it's on my Facebook page. You can take a look on the Facebook page, and I'm going to put it at the bottom of the Jewish Journal article too.
Oh, so you'll put where we would send it, in Detroit?
Yeah, if you go, because on the website it has the address. So you can just send, if you want to send clothes there, ask them about, or email them and ask them about clothes. Sure, why not? Because they have a private plane, they can fly the stuff over. Yeah. Right, that collect. Although it depends where you want to give to. If you want to give specifically to this orphanage, they won't. Right. So it depends where you want to give to. And if you want to know who's getting it, which is one of the nice things about this, now I know who I'm building bathrooms for, you know? And I know those kids. And that's the motivation of going back. The motivation of going back is to see what changed and to see how the kids are doing. Because they're, you know, it's just very... It's like by the second day, you're already their friend. That's just how their world works. Yeah.
I know Mitch has a relationship with Oprah Winfrey. Has he
does.
Gotten her involved in this mission?
Not as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What are you going
at? I don't know. I have several trips to other places this year, not like this. So I would say it's certainly not this school year. Whether I would go back this calendar year, like in the fall or the winter, I mean, that would be a nice thing, yeah.
Is the major religion for Christianity or Voodooism?
The major religion is Christianity, and Voodooism is the major fear. That is, there's a lot of voodoo, and people are afraid of it. Even the Christians are a little bit afraid of it.
It's a religion.
It is a religion, with its own priests and its own doctrines and its own ceremonies and all of that. That's what I'm told. You know, so last question. Yeah.
English.
Yes.
When do they start learning it? Kind of what percentage of kids in the orphanage?
In the orphanage, I would say about half of them, or a little less than half of them, understand English, and some of them speak it very well. Eventually, all of them will. But they're supposed to start learning it when they're young, but not all of them do. It depends how they get there. If they get there at age 10 from Haitian parents, they probably don't speak English. If they get there at age 3 or 4, then by the time they're 7 or 8, they'll have learned English. Yeah. Yes.
You imply- implied that English was sort of a way up and out.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about why that is?
Just because if you want to work professionally in Haiti, yeah. English is the language. I mean, English is the international language. All the tourists, all the money, all the international business, it's all in English. I mean, where else are you going to speak Creole? You know, it's
Louisiana.
Only, right, Louisiana. It's only if, yeah, if you're working in the market, maybe. But other than that, you're stuck, you know? So.
Did you all bring your own food? Or did
we
you
all brought our own food. We ate nothing. I mean, nothing that was created in Haiti other than some mangoes that we washed off very carefully. The best mangoes in the world, by the way. Don't taste anything like mangoes here because of the cholera. Because of cholera. They brought endless amounts of bottled water. You don't drink any water there. You can shower in it, but the only reason you can shower in it is because the orphanage put in a chlorination system, so there's chlorine in the water that comes through the shower. Otherwise, you couldn't shower in it either. Because cholera is, and the shame about cholera is that it's curable. It's curable. All you need, I brought a couple of pills with me. That was it. It's just a function of getting people to medical treatment in time. And the people who've died of cholera have died of cholera just because they didn't see a doctor. Mm-hmm. Because that's all it requires, right? Yeah. It's not typhus. I mean, you just need a couple of pills and you're done. So anyway, thank you. Next time we'll resume the Torah.